This is the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, businesses consider how to handle the health care overhaul. Minnesota factories do more with less. And Monticello hopes to escape its broadband debt. First, MnDOT has closed part of the interchange between Interstate 35W and Highway 13 after crews discovered damage to a bridge there. Painting crews working over the weekend found structural damage to the underside of the Highway 13 overpass in Burnsville. Kevin Gutnick is a spokesman for MnDOT.
The folks who were looking at it think it could have been some sort of equipment that was being carried down 35W that set high up on the bed. It might have nicked the bridge.
Gutnick says experts will assess the situation today to determine the extent of the damage and what kind of repairs are needed. It is not clear how long it will take to make those repairs, although damage on the other side of the bridge took about a week. Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox are the faces of Minsure, Minnesota's new online health insurance marketplace. The state is contracting with BBDO Proximity Minneapolis for a roughly $9 million marketing campaign. At the campaign's launch yesterday, BBDO Creative Director Brian Croning said he wanted the advertising to be easy to understand, local, and upbeat.
Because this is, in fact, great news for those that are uninsured. We liked Paul and Babe because everybody seems to recognize them. They were easy to work with. We were looking for what's unique to Minnesota. The ball of twine's agent was harder.
I've never seen the ball of twine. But billboards with Bunyan and Babe's images go up today, along with Minsure's advertising on buses and in skyways and newspapers. The campaign's motto, the land of 10,000 reasons to get health insurance. Across the state, companies are in the midst of a tricky calculus. The federal health care law requires all businesses with more than 50 full-time workers to offer health insurance. If they don't, they could face hefty fines. Some of the state's employers say both options are too expensive, and they're looking for ways to get around the requirement and the penalty. Reporter Catherine Richard talked with Tom Cran on All Things Considered about that.
We've heard a lot about the individual mandate that's part of the health care law. Explain how the employer mandate works.
Well, the law requires that all individuals have health insurance, but it also requires many employers actually offer it. The long story short is that any employer with 50 or more workers putting in at least 30 hours a week has to provide health insurance. It must be affordable, it has to cover certain benefits, and it needs to be extended to up to 95% of the company's workforce.
Is this proving to be a lot for businesses to sort through?
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's so complex that the Obama administration decided to delay the mandate until 2015 so businesses have more time to figure out whether they need to comply or not.
So what will happen to employers who don't meet those requirements by that new deadline, now 2015?
Well, it gets expensive really fast. The first 30 uninsured employees are free, but after that, the fine is $2,000 a head, and that could add up really quickly.
Do we know how this penalty will apply to a lot of businesses here in Minnesota at this point?
It's really hard to say exactly how many, but what we do know is that most large companies that already offer insurance are likely in compliance and not a whole lot is going to change for their employees. It's the businesses that rely on a lot of hourly labor and that haven't offered benefits to those workers in the past that are struggling with what to do. Think retail, hospitality, restaurant, that sort of thing.
Okay.
I spoke with a guy named Doug Sams, who's grappled with this exact question. He owns D. Bryan's Delis. This is a catering company and restaurant chain throughout the Twin Cities. He says about 80 employees are on his payroll at any given time, and they work more than 30 hours every week. At first, he thought he would just pay the fine, but it would cost him well over $100,000 a year, and that was just too expensive for him. Then he considered cutting his employees' hours and bringing them under that 30-hour-a-week threshold, but he thought that was really unfair to his staff and just in good conscience couldn't do that. So Sams has finally settled on offering health insurance. But there's an interesting twist here. He's banking on the fact that most of his employees won't take him up on the offer because they won't think it's affordable. And that's exactly what happened when he offered them a 401k retirement plan. Now, those employees that don't sign up for his insurance will have to pay a fine, but it's probably going to be less than the plan's monthly premiums.
This idea of cutting employee hours, this really isn't new, but are we going to see more of this happening?
Yeah, you know, the short answer is yes. Like you said, it's not really a new tactic. Lots of businesses have kept their employees in part-time status so they don't have to give them benefits. But in the city of Faribault, that's exactly what's happening. Four city workers will work less than 30 hours starting next summer, so the city doesn't have to shell out about $60,000 for health insurance. And from what the lawyers and insurance brokers and benefits consultants I spoke with have told me, that's not an isolated case.
So it seems like there are the three avenues here. You cut or keep hours below a certain point, you pay the penalty or the fine, or you offer insurance coverage. Do we have a sense of what employers are ultimately likely to do?
Well, that's the big question. There's a recent study done suggesting cutting hours won't be that common. Less than 20% of Midwestern firms are taking that approach or thinking about taking that approach. But here's what I found really interesting. Paying the penalty doesn't seem to be likely either. St. Paul insurance broker David Cornell told me that when he's crunched the numbers for his clients, paying the penalty is rarely the cheapest option, partly because, unlike the cost of paying health insurance, this fine isn't tax deductible. In fact, a local employee benefits consultant told me that he actually expects to see more companies offer insurance as the economy starts to recover, and that's a way to stay competitive and to attract the best workers.
Catherine Richard, thanks for the update.
No problem.
There's more from Catherine on this online at nprnews.org.
And that's NPR's Tom Cran. St. Cloud officials are set to announce expansion of air service at their regional airport this week. According to a release from the Greater St. Cloud Development Corporation, an unnamed airline and destination will be announced tomorrow morning. Bill Toll is the airport director in St. Cloud.
The airline has asked us not to say anything, just to let folks know that there is going to be some additional air service out of the St. Cloud Regional Airport, and they've asked us to keep that under our hat until their official announcement is made.
Currently, Allegiant Air is the only commercial service to fly out of St. Cloud with two flights per week to Mesa, Arizona. St. Cloud officials have an ongoing campaign to bring an additional carrier to the airport. Before Allegiant's arrival into the market, St. Cloud had been without regional service since Delta pulled out of the market in late 2009. Minnesota's factories are churning out more products these days, but they're not hiring. More output is not translating to more jobs, just the opposite. Manufacturing employment in Minnesota is now lower than it was last year. Annie Baxter has a report.
It's been a little tricky to figure out what's happening these days at factories around the state. On the one hand, new orders and sales were up in a recent survey of Minnesota's manufacturers by Creighton University. But on the other hand, exports have been slackening. And in June, factory employment in the state fell below the count of a year before. That decline is a major reversal. Early in the recession, manufacturing was a leader in employment growth. But some people don't seem worried by what's going on in manufacturing.
We don't see the sector declining despite these reductions in jobs over the past year.
Rob Grunewald is an economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Grunewald says, yes, it's true. Manufacturers in Minnesota are not keeping pace with other industries in terms of job growth. And weaker exports have caused the industry to soften a bit. But Minnesota's manufacturing sector has nevertheless been churning out products at a faster rate than the state's overall economy. At least that's true for 2012, the most recent data available.
It's still growing, so it's still adding output to our economy.
In short, factories are producing more stuff with fewer workers.
The way that we stay competitive, like it or dislike it, is trying to figure out how to take labor content out of our jobs.
Steve Carlson is president of Kurt Manufacturing. At one of the company's factories in Fridley, they make things like the flaps on airplane wings. Throughout the factory, machines are increasingly taking over the tasks people used to do. Carlson points to a system that looks like a double-decker bus. It's about 45 feet long, 16 feet high, and has two rows of windows. The machine will turn breadbox-sized aluminum blocks into finished parts, like a component for the airplane wing flap. It can even fetch the parts on its own.
A cart will come down and pick that whole pallet up and move it into the machine and do the machining and bring it back and put it back into its position like this finished part here.
No human brawn is necessary, and the machine can run all night and weekend. Eventually, a worker will need to conduct a quality inspection, but the machine can even do some of that itself. For Carlson, the question is whether hiring people or buying machines is the best use of the company's financial resources.
You make the decision, okay, do I spend $100,000 on a piece of equipment that can eliminate two people? Or do I bring those two people back and spend an equivalent amount of money annually on or more on labor costs and salaries?
Rob Grunewald at the Minneapolis Fed says he'll be watching manufacturing to see if recent job loss trends continue. That could signal a weakening economy and not just factory owners deciding in favor of machines over workers. But for the time being, Grunewald says the recent drop in manufacturing employment is not panic-inducing.
The year-over-year change is not large. It's notable because it is down.
And Grunewald says the good thing is other parts of the economy, like construction, are picking up. Grunewald says those other industries can now take over the role manufacturing was playing earlier on in goosing job growth.
Business reporter Annie Baxter on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. From time to time, we check in with the editor of Minnesota Today and the editor of Today's Question, Michael Olson at nprnews.org. Michael, hello.
Hello, Phil.
Well, we've got a story today that you're following about a new poll.
Yeah, on Minnesota Today, we are looking at this survey that that says that it shows strong support for closing Minneapolis locks. And what that would be, what this all gets to, is the Asian carp. Mm. There's a group, the Stop Carp Coalition, that released the survey. So number one, that should be a bit of a red flag since it's an activist group releasing a poll that is supportive of their position. Mm-hmm. But what they're saying, and it is 404 registered voters that were surveyed, and they're saying that 63% of those surveyed favor a proposal to create a physical barrier to stop the carp by closing the locks or gate in the Mississippi River in Minneapolis.
And are we hearing what the opponents of that say? I guess who are the opponents?
Well, the opponents, I guess it comes to more commerce concerns. Mm. That if you aren't moving cargo through there, you have to move it on a truck or some other way. So if you, it would be more costly.
And on Today's Question, you have a question about, I guess, the big international story of the day and the last several days, really.
Yes, we're focusing on Egypt. That's what we pose to folks, ask people, should the U.S. Cut military aid to Egypt? And we're getting a pretty mixed response on this. Some folks are saying that, you know, under current law, the U.S. must suspend aid where governments are unseated via coup. This is something that's been out there for a while after the change in power and the military coup. But then you have other folks saying it's not going to make any difference to the Egyptian people if we do or don't cut military aid. It seems that most of the money that we give Egypt in military aid is funneled back into U.S. corporations that build the 20 F-16 aircraft we are selling them. Hmm. And, you know, just as a point of reference, the U.S. gives approximately $1.5 billion in military aid annually to Egypt.
Now, last week, there was a controversial issue, a controversial question, the pedal pub question that came up last Friday, I believe.
Yes, very controversial. Seems like also trivial in light of asking about Egypt. But, you know, people have very strong feelings about the pedal pub. Last week there was a crash by a pedal pub. Apparently was,
and this is where the people sit on, they're like pedaling a bicycle, and it's like a bar that goes down the street that they can drink whatever they're drinking and ride and pedal at the same time.
Yes. So it's, you know, most people in the Twin Cities have seen these, maybe been held up behind them, moving a little bit slower. They're a 10-seat bike. So you have 10 people that pedal it, and then one person who's sitting in the center that's steering it. And so it's relatively wide. It's about as wide as a car. And they move slow because it's heavy. But this one in Minneapolis was going down a hill and making a turn to go up another hill, and apparently was going too fast, and it tipped over on its side. The authorities that were there, Minneapolis police, said that it was mostly scratches that were sustained, although two people were sent to the hospital. Hmm. What this provided was, one, is kind of a, well, duh, of course, people that are drinking on a bike and hollering and having a grand old time as they go about their day are probably going to get in a wreck, even though the driver is supposed to be sober. And there's no indication at this point that the driver was partaking in the and the libations as everyone else was, that that's the person who was actually paid to steer the vehicle. They're an employee of Pedal Pub. But this, it circulated everywhere around social media, just the spectacle. People have a lot of it. It came out very clearly that people have strong feelings about these pedal pubs tying up traffic. A lot of the folks that are on them are loud and obnoxious as they go by. And so we were asking folks what they think of this, if they're a fan of the pedal pub, because, you know, quite frankly, it seems like it's maybe a fun time.
Yeah, it seems like it would be a fun time. But as someone who has driven through the city and been stopped by them, or, you know, had to, I guess, yield as one was crossing an intersection, you can see how it could be perceived to be a dangerous activity as well.
Right, right. And it really has brought out, I would say, generally the consensus is that no one likes them, at least the people that were weighing in on the question here. I'm sure there are people out there. Maybe this question was posted too early for them to respond. But then you have what I thought was interesting that came out of this is that, all right, we can hate on these pedal pubs, but also there's a strong anti-regulation thrust to the responses, saying you might hate them, but there's no need to regulate them anymore.
Interesting. All right, Michael Olson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Olson, the editor of Today's Question and Minnesota Today at nprnews.org. The city of Monticello could soon own its broadband network free of debt. The city sold $26 million in bonds to pay for the construction of the network in 2008. But aggressive competition from the private sector has put the publicly owned internet, television, and phone service company in a financially precarious position. In July of 2012, the city defaulted on its debt payment. Now, Conrad Wilson reports the bondholders who financed the network's construction are deciding whether or not to take the city's settlement offer, a return of 22 cents on the dollar.
Since it began providing service in 2010, the city of Monticello's broadband network hasn't been able to compete with prices for internet, phone, and television service offered by private companies. That's in part because the city had debt payments it had to make to its bondholders. In June, the city made a formal offer to bondholders, paying back more than $5 million of the $26 million borrowed to finance the construction of the network. Monticello City Administrator Jeff O'Neill says it's unclear whether the city's broadband network may ever generate enough business to give bondholders a better return. In a statement, he says the city wants to reach a settlement that provides bondholders, quote, with an early buyout greater than what their bonds are currently worth, in exchange for their releasing the city from further obligations under the bonds. The settlement offer comes as local governments around the state and country seeking faster internet service weigh whether or not to finance and build their own broadband networks. Rick Frimmer is the attorney representing the city of Monticello's bondholders.
The bonds were issued based upon revenues of the system. The system failed to produce any revenues. That's the risk that bondholders took.
There is a risk if bondholders don't approve the deal. There's a chance they could get an even smaller return than the 22 cents on the dollar the city's offering. At least 90% of bondholders must agree to the settlement. Otherwise, Frimmer says it's not valid.
It remains to be seen whether or not the required number of bondholders don't elect out of the settlement. But we're highly hopeful that that's what will happen.
Monticello's tale kindles the debate over whether local governments should build their own broadband networks or whether the projects are best left to private companies. In Monticello's case, the city built the network because it wasn't able to convince the incumbent provider, TDS, to upgrade to faster internet. Shortly after the city decided to build the network, TDS filed a lawsuit that delayed and nearly derailed the city's construction. While the city spent more than a year sorting out the lawsuit, TDS installed the very upgrades residents asked for years earlier. Christopher Mitchell, director of the Telecommunications Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, says Monticello's broadband network is the victim of predatory pricing.
Monticello has recognized it cannot pay back its bonds in this environment, and so it's restructuring its debt. Bondholders are having to take a haircut in order to make sure that the network will be able to continue and to keep bringing benefits to the people of Monticello.
Among the benefits to consumers the city's broadband provides, Mitchell says, is competition. Barry Fick, Senior Vice President at the financial advising firm Springstead Incorporated, says the settlement should have minimal impact on the city's credit rating. Fick's firm advised the city on the project. He says it was clear to investors from the start they were signing onto a risky project where the debt was tied to the project's revenue.
Long term, I think this will help the city, everything else being equal, to improve their credit rating because they no longer have this large debt outstanding and having to generate lots of revenue from the system.
Fick says beyond the risk bondholders were taking, there were factors beyond the city's control, like the economic recession, that hurt the project's financial success. If bondholders agree to the terms outlined by the city, the settlement could be finalized by the end of the year.
That's Conrad Wilson in St. Cloud. Fargo city officials are developing a plan to burn natural gas in city vehicles. Here's our Dan Gunderson.
Fargo City Commissioner Mike Williams says natural gas has many advantages over diesel fuel.
Burns cleaner, it has more power, and it's cheaper, so that's a good combination.
Natural gas is more than $2 a gallon cheaper than diesel, but there's one big problem. There's no place to fill vehicles with natural gas.
We need to basically create a market, because right now there's no vehicles here because there's no fueling stations here.
Williams says a fueling station costs as much as $1 million.
But when you're spending $4 million a year in fuel, if you could save 50% of that, you could get your payback pretty quick.
Williams says the city could also allow private businesses to use the natural gas fueling station. The city commission will consider the plan late this year. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
A team of scientists has begun a 10-day trip on the Great Lakes searching for microplastics, tiny plastic beads that researchers fear could be harming fish. Dan Crocker reports.
Last year, a team of researchers discovered huge numbers of tiny plastic beads, less than a millimeter in diameter, in Lakes Superior, Huron, and Erie. This summer, they'll extend their search to Lakes Michigan and Ontario. Chemist Lorena Rios-Mendoza at the University of Wisconsin-Superior says some fish she has analyzed in Lake Superior are eating the plastic.
When they try to pass through the gut, can block the gut or can stuck in the stomach.
It's still unclear where the plastic comes from, but researchers suspect they're abrasive microbeads that are used in personal care products like facial and body washes. Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Duluth.
Officials from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education are holding a workshop at Augsburg College today for students applying for financial aid under the state's new DREAM Act. Here's our Rupa Shenoy.
The act became law in May. A week ago, Minnesota launched its online application for students living illegally in the state who are seeking financial aid. State Financial Aid Program Manager Ginny Dodds says about 30 people have applied so far. Many were brought to the country as children. Some are current college students who've been financing their own education. Dodds says her office is working hard to manually process applications before the school year starts.
We'll be letting schools know who has applied for their campus and then hopefully asking them if they can defer tuition so students won't be dropped for non-payment.
The state is holding a series of workshops to help students complete applications. Rupa Shenoy, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That's it for the Monday NPR News Update. Thanks for listening. The Tuesday podcast found right back here tomorrow. Till then, so long.